Stimate colleghe, colleghi, studentesse, studenti, signore e signori, buongiorno. My name is Marcello Romano, I'm a professor of Space Systems Engineering here at Politecnico di Torino. It is a privilege for the Biennale di Tecnologia and for Politecnico di Torino to host today Professor Heinz Stöver. Professor Stöver is a world expert in the field of space systems engineering. He is an emeritus professor of space systems engineering at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. He was the first to hold this chair in 1986. Professor Stöver also worked at Airbus Space and Defense, at Boeing in the United States, at European Space Agency, and at the German Aerospace Center, DLR. He is also a member of the board of OHB and a distinguished visiting scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Professor Stöver is the former president of International Council of Systems Engineering, ENCOS, and he is the recipient of many prestigious recognitions, including the Netherlands Space Society NVR Space Award 2022, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers IEEE Simon Remo Medal 2018. We are now in the 65th year of the space era after Sputnik's launch, and space systems engineering and the space sector in general are at a critical evolutionary juncture, comparable as regards to the aviation realm to the introduction of the jet engine between the 30s and the 50s, or as regards the information technology to the invention and introduction of the World Wide Web in the second half of the 90s. Professor Stöver will offer us an authoritative and inspiring perspective in his Lectio Magistralis, which is titled Space Systems and Our Global Sustainability Challenges. I'm glad the Biennale organizers used the designation Lectio Magistralis, as the Latin word magister carries in its meaning a connotation much deeper and broader than any other academic titles used nowadays. It is now my distinct honor to invite to the podium Professor Heinz Stöver.
Thank you, Marcello.
And I would like to say, Magister, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, students. Space is, particularly here in Torino, present all the time. But so is sustainability, one of the big challenges that we have as humankind these days. So I'm trying to see that the two of them, space and sustainability, might possibly fit together. You're the judge, and we'll see that in about 45 minutes from now. So, you thought you're in Torino. Really, are you? Well, I'll let you show another place where you didn't think you might have been. You're really out there somewhere in the universe, in this case, in our Milky Way, a little spot somewhere which is practically indiscernible if you look through the width of our universe. But keep one thing in mind, and that's why I put this chart up. Space has many dimensions, and I put this chart up to give you the dimension of we have learned through space and astronomy, obviously, since many centuries before, that we're just a little spot somewhere in the universe. That should make us proud, but it should make us modest at the same time. Now, before I enter my presentation, let me share with you my great pleasure to be back in Torino. And I explain that in a moment, but first I would like to give a very sincere thank to Professor Romano for having brought me here for this lecture, which I do with great pleasure. The reason why I'm so happy that to be back here is because I spent quite some time in Torino in the 1970s. I was the first program manager of the European Space Agency to develop SpaceLab. And at that time, we started at zero knowledge. We started on a white piece of paper. It was a, what we call it nowadays, it was a startup at that time. And this development of SpaceLab has led to lots of things. I was out yesterday in Thales Alenia and saw the full production halls, which goes beyond what we dreamt of at the time that we started SpaceLab. I had many other relationships with Italian colleagues. For example, we pursued the tether concept, two satellites connected through a string together. We flew a number of radar missions, full radar missions in the shuttle, and many other things. And obviously, Columbus and the space station development were also very, very close collaboration between Germany and Italy. So, SpaceLab is really the start of the Torino space development. When I first came here, Professor Valerani, who is a very, very close friend and who I've just visited a couple of days ago, started in a bullpen without a fax, without a secretary, without anything. So it was really startup from the very beginning. And we were all a young, very young crew across Europe, but we said, arms up, we go do it. And I'm so proud that what has happened and come from there. And I brought two mementos with me, mementos which are, the first one is the, what we call the most expensive aluminum cuttings ever, because it was the first aluminum cuts which was done in Torino on space hardware. And the second one was the first welding that was done on aluminum structures, which eventually brought us into SpaceLab and beyond. So much why I'm happy to be back in Torino and been very happy to go through the facilities yesterday in Thales Alenia out there and see the many hardware things, the many projects that have developed ever since. So, my talk today is really on three topics. I first want to give you a little bit perspective following my very first chart on the recent astrophysics results and the prospects of life. Do they belong together somehow or other to create the big and broader perspectives? I will then go into satellites, show you a few examples and ask the question, do satellites and sustainability fit together? And then I go into space exploration and the long-term sustainability, and there's where I close the loop with the first topic and the first chart that I've used. I have four subjects, four objects in front of you here. Firstly, a chart which shows you we have infinite objects out there, which raises, of course, a number of questions. Secondly, a comet, we call him Chury, it's the nickname of it, it's a long name, a long Russian name, which has some messages for us from outer space. Thirdly, I show you the latest asteroid that we've been flying to and that we've been able to deflect. And the last one is, I will ask the question, does the sun, our star of our solar system, support life forever? And what conclusions might be drawn out of these? First, let me share with you a absolutely couple of beautiful pictures, the pillars of creation on your left, and one of the first shots of the James Webb telescope. It just shows, next to the beauty of space, of course, also many, many other dimensions, namely that essentially all space, all objects in space are created from dust. Dust is everywhere. just like water is everywhere. Now, the eternal question, of course, that we always have, is there life out there? In some form? In which form? Where? To make the answer short, we don't know. But still, it creates an imagination and a desire to know, which is very strong and is one of the elements of motivation for doing space. Now, we have known for a long time, since the first telescope, ESA telescope ISO in the 1980s, that there's water. In this vacuum out in space, there's water practically everywhere. Now, we've started to learn little by little that there's anorganic molecules, that there is various different carbon derivatives, etc., etc. But what we've learned only since August of this year is that there are, in a comet, which is very, very far away, there are fragrance. When I first saw this publication, I fell off my chair. I wouldn't believe it, but I know the people who've published this, specialists in spectroscopy at the University of Bern, and they're very, very serious scientists. So they found naphthalene, that's mothballs, which you have in your closet. They found incense, which, of course, you find in every good Catholic church. And they found almond flavor in a comet infinitely far away from here. Now, what does this mean? Well, I add the Hayabusa, that's a Japanese mission to Ryugu, another asteroid, found similar, but not the fragrance. Anyway, what does this mean? If you think it through, it means, and I know I'm making a big step there, that the chemistry of our prebiotic early Earth is essentially prevalent everywhere in space. Now, you couple this conclusion, which is not mine, it comes from a colleague from the University of Illinois, with some of the questions, is there life out there, which I brought up before? I'll leave it to you to conclude. Now, the next point is, we know that the dinosaurs have been eliminated through an asteroid impact and the subsequent conclusions. But we have lots of asteroid impacts. The chart that you see there is all little asteroid impacts across the Earth. But what we have achieved just recently is fly into one of those little asteroids, little but big in potential impact on Earth, and deviate its trajectory. That deviation has given us the certainty that if there is going to be another dangerous asteroid, we can do something about it. And that's the key conclusion from there. And the asteroids didn't have a space agency, so that was their pity. We do. So we're in a better shape. Now, what is the life cycle of our sun? Our sun is like any other star, almost like any other star, out in our universe. It's about 4.57 billion years old. We've pretty well identified that. And it burns hydrogen into helium to create energy. But it has a limited life cycle, like every star out there. And the question is, of course, how long is that going to be? It's another 3.5 billion years. That's a lot of time. Don't get scared. But in that period, up to 3.5 billion years, it will slowly eat up our inner planets, and it will also slowly eat up our Earth. This is not really new. It is just by analyzing what is a star, what is a lifetime of any star out there. So, this is very far in the future. So again, don't be scared. It doesn't happen tomorrow, and it doesn't happen to your children or your grandchildren or your descendants immediately. But it is a fact, And this is really the point that I want to get across. We have a finite destiny, finite life cycle on this planet. Okay, so what do those astrophysical observations tell us? Firstly, there's infinite bodies out there. Question, is there life? We don't know. There's lots of molecules out there which, not only on Earth, but many other bodies in this universe will also exist. Our sun's lifetime is limited. I mentioned this very clearly. Now, you could take the pessimistic approach. Stephen Hawking said, we are behaving on this planet in a way that he says we have only 100 years to go before we blow up this planet. This is a very pessimistic view, but I had a recent discussion with a close colleague in ETH Zurich. Says, this is pessimistic 100. I give the Earth another 1,000 years. No. I leave this observation with you. Don't want to debate it, but the Earth has a limited life cycle. So in conclusion, this is now my conclusion where I come back to space activities, space systems. We have indispensable options. We need to create options for the future of mankind and long-term survival. There's another dimension of space which you may not have thought about at all so far. So far, the very, very, very broad picture. Let me come to more practical things. Satellites and short-term sustainability with a question mark. My first point is, what is sustainability? And I don't want to go into this one. There's hundreds of definitions, but it really has to do with resources minimization, with maximum reuse, and with minimal environmental impact. It is really about circular economy. The circular economy simply says we need to do these things which I've stated in red in the chart before. And there's many examples. I've taken a German car out as an example, which is a new experimental car of BMW, where they've not only have biomaterials as part of building the car, they have turned around the whole design philosophy of cars to make sure they are conforming to the three criteria which I've mentioned before. Now, space has come a long way. We started it 65 years ago with Sputnik, and since then we've launched about 9,000 satellites. We've had about 600 astronauts up in orbit, and the space sector has created an economic dimension which is enormous and which is going on a very clear slope up there. So, my next chart is what's happening in the building of satellites and the building of launchers. And I simply want to show you this curve without going into detail there either. We have lots of startups, and we have lots of private investment in space in the last 10 years. We had no private investment 20 years ago, or hardly any, but we are in a different phase of space compared to where we were 5, 10, 20 years ago. So, my wife gave me a wonderful chart which describes better than anything else that I could say about new space. If you read the literature, everybody talks about new space. Well, I could talk a lot about it, but new space, when we started here in Torino, the space lab development, that was new space because we started from scratch and no experience, but we did it. So everyone said, this will not work. And this is really my message to you students. Then someone who did not know it just did it. And that's partially new space, and I'll show you some examples as we go along. Another general point, if you look into this commercial expansion, ask yourself why. You come to one general observation, which is data is the gold of the 21st century. And space is feeding this gold rush in many ways. And I give you a little on the green on the bottom of the chart. We will launch more satellites in the next 10 years than we've launched in the 65 years since Sputnik. That shows you the dynamics of space. It shows you what's happening out there. And it also shows you how many opportunities there are for you students in particular. I have a few examples now, and I could do these examples infinitely further, but it's only about a dozen or so. Firstly, we're monitoring the changes on our Earth daily. There's a fleet of satellites out there which tell us what's happening to water, what's happening to geodesy, what's happening to our forests, what's happening to all kinds of things that happen on our planet. And the question that flows with us is, can we mitigate? Can we do something about these changes? And this has a bit to do already with sustainability. The next point I want to make is space weather. 30 years ago, we didn't know there was something like space weather, but space weather has a lot of effect on every satellite that's up there, obviously, but also on our energy production, on our well-being on the Earth, because space weather changes the radiation that we receive. It changes a lot. It affects electronics and many other things. Another example is our magnetic north has gotten an acceleration. It used to be over north of China, Siberia, in the 1900s. It is now moving at about 55 kilometers a year towards Russian Siberia. Question is why? And the reason for this, or not the reason for this, I cannot explain. But I can tell you that we've sophisticated satellites. We can now look into the Earth. It's an indirect measurement, but it was through satellites that we found out that the inner core of our Earth has a jet stream. Something which is very, very recent of satellites, which we started in Germany, and NASA and JPL is continuing them. ESA is also working on it. There's a jet stream going on in the liquid part of our iron core. And that jet stream has, of course, an effect on magnetic environment, which is another one of those conclusions and something that we find from space. I don't need to tell you much about weather satellites, but weather satellites have become an indispensable means of our day-to-day life. Before we travel to Rome, we look at what's the weather in Rome. Before we fly to the Maldives, we want to see what's the temperature there, etc. And we use it. We use it day to day. Don't need to spend much time. A couple of words though on water. Our water resources are not infinite either, and that's a conclusion which we need to draw. Firstly, we have a problem because of the temperature change, that there is going to be melting of glaciers. I use Greenland as an example of where it is happening. I could have used the Antarctic, I could have used the Alps. As a matter of fact, if you look at the glaciers of the Alps, they're going back, etc., etc. Now, if you live on the Maldives, you're very, very concerned about this. Because, as you can see in this little chart there, they expect the sea level to be in a place where they don't exist anymore. Second point on water is, we're using water, particularly water in the deep grounds, as if it were infinite. The effect of this, we measured with satellites. The Joaquin Valley in California is the vegetable source of most all of America and many, many other things. You can see on the chart on your right how much the land has subsided as a result of taking all this groundwater out and not replacing it. It's not infinite. There's more to come. So my point is very simple. in 3 years from now, that's a quote of Bayer, a little company in the world, let's say, water is going to become a more expensive and more scarce resource, more important resource than carbon is today. Our politicians talk only about carbon, or mostly about carbon, should talk as much about water in the same way. Now, let me switch from not looking at the Earth, but communicating across the Earth. It's all about connectivity. We have a connectivity way of living which is entirely different from what we had 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and more. Some good, not all good, but that's a different story. We have started to launch satellites in what we call constellations. You see on your left, constellations are many satellites flying around the Earth and communicating down to the Earth with the objective of providing data exchange between Indonesia and Italy and between Alaska and South Africa, and by giving us the means to understand better what's happening, one of the goals being an internet in space. Internet in space, and not just fiberglass on the Earth. It's coming. It's coming as we speak. It's going to take a couple of more years and we're going to be there. My next example is maybe even better known. It's the Starlink constellation by SpaceX, by a gentleman like Elon Musk, who has a few billions in his pockets, which he's created through lots of things. Again, it is this way of looking at satellites and seeing how satellites can help this and change this Earth and help people. If I give you some numbers, it's about 3,500 satellites which this company, SpaceX, has already launched. 3,500 satellites in the last 6 years, and they want to launch 30,000 more. They don't have the approval of the 30,000 yet, but that's the way they're moving. But as a side remark, it's the Starlink constellation that has helped the Ukrainians conduct their defense against the Russian forces in a much more effective way than anybody has ever thought before. My next example is, and this is really, where is space communications moving to? We're starting to build satellites, which you see on your left up there, which are huge football field of antennas. What's the purpose? The purpose is to get from this football field of antennas directly to your mobile device. Today, your mobile device goes through terrestrial providers, except Apple has already created in its 14th generation a link into space. But the idea is get satellites and mobile devices connected in your pocket, in industry, on your computer, etc. That means a communication revolution which is going to change a lot of the ways we communicate. Give another practical example. You can ask the question, why is it a Chinese auto firm, automaker, who is planning in the order of 1,000 more satellites to support just their car fleet for autonomous driving? Why is it not Fiat, Volkswagen, Mercedes? I don't have the answer to it. But it says a lot of things about what you can do with satellites, and that a company building cars can afford 1,000 satellites if their economic model supports it. And obviously, they're working very intensely around this. Another example, navigation satellites. A couple of days ago, my wife and I, we drove from Lugano to Orta Lake. Without navigation, I think we would have taken twice as long. expended three times as much diesel, and with the navigation we have, it's just like electricity. It's just there. It's wonderful. It's really wonderful. Your excellent trains use it. You use it personally everywhere all the time. The next topic I could talk for at least the next half hour, but that's not really what I want to do. I want to make a few messages. And the message is, we have a treaty for the peaceful use of outer space, which is as old as 1962, and was signed by, I think, almost 200 nations. Is it still valid? All right, you can answer that question. The point is, there is a lot of satellites up there for communication, for precise location of where all kinds of enemies are, etc., etc. They are part of our life, whether we like it or not. Doesn't really matter. The point, it's a fact. My almost philosophical question is, what approach will succeed in the next decades? I'm not thinking next year, but if we think 20, 30, 40 years ahead, you students are going to be in the middle of your life by then, and I hope you're going to not forget this chart and the original intention, which we certainly had. Anyway, one thing is for sure, namely that there will be many more satellites and space vehicles which will serve the defensive posture of our countries. That's a fact, that's a definite trend, etc., etc. Now, I could expand these examples, at least a few hundred more, to show you how space has entered our daily life, our economy, and more. But instead, I will just draw a little step more into the future and tell you where I think, where things are going, where space is moving. We will have every pixel of our Earth monitored and documented. And this is happening as we speak. There's people working on a digital twin of our Earth, which is fantastic. Digital twin of our Earth gives us so many more opportunities for dealing with what's happening on Earth. Just as a little example, we have navigation systems which will go into the centimeter and millimeter accuracy in the years to come. And we will have affordable communication for 7 billion people. It's happening as we speak as well. My point there is, and this is a point to my space friends, the stovepipes that we have at present, telecom, Earth observation, navigation, etc., will start to merge together into what I call an integrated service from space for Earth. Eventually, this will lead to one interface on your mobile, on your computer, in your factory, and you don't care whether the information comes from a navigation satellite, communication satellite, company X, company Y. It will eventually be something like this plug for electricity. You just draw space services into your life, whichever way you choose to want to do it. Now, I don't want to create a peachy keen and wonderful, wonderful story here. We have also messed up space. Let me be very clear, we have not paid attention to sustainability. We've not paid attention to having space clean and keeping it clean, which means there's a lot of schrott up there. Now, you can see this, it's in the papers, in the publications everywhere. It's not quite as serious, but it is very serious in itself. Also, these many satellites that fly across our low Earth orbit impair our astronomical observations, something that concerns me. It also, we don't reuse every launch vehicle that we build. neither the San Marco nor, I mean, the Vega nor the Ariane nor all the American ones. So from a point of view of sustainability and the criteria I've used before, there's lots of things yet to be done. So my view is, and here's a compliment to Simonetta, who's pointed me in that, the people pointed me in this direction, because I was always talking about IATA, but it's really, we need an ICAO for space. ICAO regulates our air traffic on Earth in lots of ways. We need something like this for space, and we need it soon, because the mess up there is getting worse and not better as we speak. So, the question on satellites: do satellites and sustainability really fit together? I could give you my answer, but I've chosen to give you a different answer. You may all know the 17 development goals, sustainable development goals of the United Nations. They are fairly encompassing and covering the needs for a population, whether that's population in India or in California or in South America, doesn't matter, in principle, they all. And the question is, can space contribute to these? So, the space 2030 agenda of the United Nations says space is a driver of sustainable development. Not my words, it's there. Now, three quotes from the United Nations General Assembly resolution of 25 October 2021. The first one is relatively clear, and I think I made this point throughout. The second one is really interesting because it says, we emphasize that space tools are highly relevant for the attainment of global development agendas, in particular the 2030 agenda, which I've just shown you, on sustainable developments. The third one is something which is, for you as engineers and scientists, relatively evident. It has an effect on what we do on Earth. So, my question: could the global United Nations Conference on World Climate, Paris, Glasgow, and Sharm el-Sheikh at the moment, really take place without space? Without the long-term data series that we have, which give us the evolution and the changes on our planet? You can answer this for yourself. The next question is, can the European Green Deal work without satellites? I've heard many pitches on the Green Deal. I have heard no one speaking about space in that context. I think they're wrong. They're just not paying enough attention to what is happening around us. And I could go on and on and on. Automated driving, we've talked about it, autonomous driving particularly, or the conferences on the planet which are going on, etc., etc., etc. So my conclusion is now the Green Deal and our planet's sustainability are unthinkable without the input and the support that comes from space. Change of subject. I go now into exploration. Close to Torino, what's happening here, obviously. And my first point is to show the ISS, the International Space Station, up there. Obviously, I have an emotional attachment to the space station because it grew out of our space lab work, our Columbus work, and there's a lot of elements up there from Italy. So from not only Italy, but from Torino. So it is a pathfinder, in my view, for life in space and more. Because despite the war that's going on at the moment, despite the upheavals that we've had and the political complexities that we've had across the world the last 15, 20 years, it still works. Our astronauts up there work as friends. They adjudicate every issue which is up there in a collaborative way. Isn't that a model for us? the follow-up, and you can see it out in Thales Alenia, are commercial space stations. Commercial space station is a natural one. I personally, but that's very, very personal, shrug a little bit by the idea that there's only commercial people out there operating space stations. And my question, of course, is we do not have a European space station, small or large at all. So do we need to rent a condominium on a Chinese space station if you want to be up there? Send our astronauts to a apartment in an American space station? Well, we can debate this a lot. There's nothing ongoing at the moment to lead us to a decision, except there is a big committee going on at the moment, which is delivering results next year and making some recommendations. So, space tourism. You can hardly open a newspaper without space tourism being in there. And most of the time, at least in German newspapers, space tourism, terrible, only for the rich, etc., etc. I challenge you to challenge these developments in the newspapers. Because if you look back 100 years ago, what's happened to the airline industry? Only the rich could afford a ticket to fly to New York. The poor one were to thousands in a ship trying to get over there. Only the rich could go to India and buy tea and import it, etc. It's happened in aviation in the same way as it is now happening in space. The dimension is different, but in principle it's exactly the same thing. And that it is happening is wonderful. 20 years from now, you're going to be able to fly up there, not for tens of millions, but maybe for hundreds of thousands of euros, which some of you, having been very, very successful in your professions, will be able to do. It's fantastic to be up there. The cupola is one of those popular things up in space, because looking down and understanding our planet from the perspective of space is quite different from just sitting here looking up. Anyway, we have a Monday next, that is 3 days from now, we will hopefully have a launch of Artemis going to the moon. It's a big step back to the moon. I hope the political support which we have at this present time will sustain that development, but I'm not 100% certain. Mars is the next destiny beyond Moon. Why? Because it used to have lots of water. We suspect there might be still remnants of microbes, of whatever, down 1.5 to 2.5 meters below the surface, protected from the radiation which is happening out there all the time. We are even going one step further, and that step further means we're going to bring samples back from Mars in the early 2030s, and that's going to be a wonderful cooperation between Europe and the US. So, the next potential step is going out to Titan. Titan has a methane-based atmosphere, and methane could be life-supporting in many ways. We don't know so far. We've landed one European probe on it, but that didn't have enough sophistication. Now, if we come back to the real challenges and what we're presenting, what we're developing at the moment, is a number of new launch vehicles, huge launch vehicles. Some of the hardware is even being built here in Torino. These launch vehicles are so powerful that we can imagine the development of human colonies eventually. But I make a big but, or before that I say, what are our options? What are human options if we now think longer term? Firstly, it's of course the Lagrange points. We have wonderful points in space, L4, L5 particularly. If you put a spacecraft there, and James Webb incidentally is there at the moment, it will be a place of peace and quiet, but very far away from Earth. The second option is Moon and Mars. I mentioned Mars just a moment ago. Or the step thereafter is Jupiter, icy moons. Europa, my favorite, my absolute favorite, an icy planet with probably much more water under this ice crust than we have on all of Earth. Ganymede, Io, Callisto, they're wonderful. And then beyond that, we can look to Titan, Enceladus, outer planets in a second wave. When you are grandfathers, you're gonna talk about this and you'll see it happening. So exoplanets, we try to understand what's happening. There are some in what we call the green zones, where there could or could not be life, and we're trying the best with various spacecraft to analyze what's really happening there. So what we really need is this little vehicle. But I'm sure when this is being built in Torino, I will wave to you from a cloud up there and say hello. That should be your goal. Star Trek is the real option. Now, the question is, can we master a balanced, sustainable exploration approach where humans and robots are working next to each other, where a lot of the robotic capabilities, the artificial intelligence capabilities that we're developing, can do a lot of work where we may not necessarily need some astronauts for. We need them anyway, but not for everything. So there's a lot of things. One thing that really gets me angry is there's been people promoting one-way travel to Mars to form colonies. This is the biggest nonsense I've heard in the last 20 years and the most irresponsible way to approaching what's happening or should be happening out there. Because if you have ever seen really close by what's happened to astronauts when they come back after 10 days or after 100 or 200 days, and how much medical care they need to refocus back on their life on Earth, you'll understand immediately that up on Mars, after 9 months of travel, it's not going to happen that quickly, no matter what Elon Musk says or what some other people say. Anyhow, we will find life out there somewhere, and sometimes it has some surprises, and this is a wonderful surprise. Let me say, and I think I'm almost in time, next week, week after next, we will have a ministerial council. This is a big event in space in Europe, and ESA is on a track of accelerating what's happening in space in Europe. And we can only cross all our fingers that they do get the support, because there's lots of things which I've talked about and which I've not talked about. But keep in mind also that space creates jobs. And if you go out again to Thales Alenia and see how many people are working now on space compared to what it was 30 years ago, it is fascinating. They're all excellent jobs and they're all opportunities for you students. So, in summary, there's a wonderful cartoonist in Germany, which I like. He said, it's very difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. And he says, the future was better in the past. So, more important for you as students is, your task is not to foresee the future, but to enable it. That's really the point. You need to make it work. get your sleeves up, like we did as young engineers, and make it happen. My next point is space and short-term sustainability. I think I've given you the answers to that. And space and long-term sustainability, that's not being debated a lot. But if we, from space, do not provide the options of where we can go as humankind, well, we may be very surprised in negative ways. So, two final philosophical reflections. I've said that I'm a fan of ISS because it's a model for how we could possibly run this Earth. Why can we not, on Earth, really take such a model to govern this planet? It may take another 50 years, but you are going to make it happen. My second point is philosophical reflection. Do we need an extraterrestrial threat? I've not talked about it, but there could be civilizations of some form, whatever form, out there. Should we discover them tomorrow, in 5 years, in 50 years, in 100 years? How would we react? Would we be able to react? Long story, think it through. So, my message is to you. This room is, I'm very happy to see, full of students. There's no alternative to sustainability. Make space an overarching peaceful tool for managing this planet. There's plenty of things we can use it for, and build a strong and independent Europe, able to decide its own destiny. We don't know what's happening in various countries, befriended countries, which are going left, right, etc., other countries. We need to find and continue our own way as Europeans, with our own value structure, making sure we're independent in Europe in many ways. So, with this, I thank you for your attention. I wish you good reflections on some of the messages I've been trying to get across to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Stover. And I would like to ask if whether there is any questions. We have about, I would say, 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes to discuss.
Who dares? There's no stupid questions, only stupid answers. Shoot off. Have I impressed you so much, or have you gone tired? Doesn't matter. Oh, here's a daring person.
First of all, thank you for the presentation. And I want to ask, can those three subjects of space go together? I mean, are they economically sustainable near space, outer space exploration, in particular those two. I mean, near space, satellites in low Earth orbit, and exploration, outer space, analyzing our galaxy. Are those, are we able to do those two to their best together, or should we focus only on one? I don't. Did you get my question?
Well, the answer to this question is very simple. It is not one or the other. The two of them, what we do in Earth orbit and what we do in going beyond Earth towards Moon, towards the outer space, they're two different things in a certain way. They take the same technology, the same launchers in part, etc., etc. The economic impact is on Earth orbits. communication, navigation, etc. There's lots of studies which say outer space, we can mine asteroids, bring back materials from out there. It's not economic. That's exploration, and exploration has its own dimensions and its own motivation for doing it. If by chance, and long term this could certainly be the case, there's also some economic benefit, superb. But it's not the driving motivation.
Thank you.
Work? Okay. I loved your presentation, of course. But I have a question. When it comes to the ocean, we only explored like not much of it. And why are we so like we want to go in space and everything, and we haven't even explored what we have here? That's my question.
Can you repeat the question? I haven't quite understood what you're
driving
at.
I mean about the ocean. Like, we haven't explored that much of it. And why aren't we, why are we focusing so much on the space if we didn't, explore what we have here?
Okay. If you're referring to the fact, why do we spend money on space and not enough on Earth?
Yes.
That's a political question.
Oh, okay.
My very personal issue is always, we need to invest more in the future because the future gives us feedback to improving our life on Earth. Now, I hope to have shown that the examples of what we do already get from space today, that is a worthwhile investment, much better than some of the other investments we've made on Earth in improving it or not improving it at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello, thank you for your presentation again. It was amazing. My question is about your last point about keeping space a peaceful environment for humankind. Do you believe we as engineers have a, future engineers at least, have a way to also make sure this happens? Or because it seems it's something out of our control, in stronger hands, let's say, like political forces, I mean.
Well, let me differentiate military space into two components. The first component is providing communication, improving communication between naval forces, between whatever. And the second one is weapons in space. Now, firstly, weapons in space are not really that effective, but that's a technical discussion, which we are not going to have now. Eventually, what's going to happen out in space will be a reflection of how we can manage this planet. If we improve Europe, if we improve the global mechanisms of the United Nations, if we eliminate war on this planet, then we will not have weapons up there and we will have a more peaceful environment. That's why I suggested it will take a few decades, but you should be working in that direction.
Thank you.
Sir, thank you very much for your presentation. And I was, as you suggested, the solar system will end when our sun will grow in a red giant. So when I think to one of the main problems in space exploration, okay, I think about distances. Okay, we are the universe is very huge, and do you think that humankind will find a way to explore and to possible to find possible other Earth in our universe to live on? Or there are there maybe other solutions when one day our solar system will finish?
The short answer is it's a matter of time. I am absolutely certain that we will create colonies in our solar system. It's not going to happen in 10 years, not in 20, but in 50, who knows? If I think back 50 years ago, where we were industrially or in space in Europe, well, we were this small, and today it's lots of things are happening if you make it happen. So it's a matter of time, and it needs to be done in an intelligent way. Think back of Apollo, one step at a time. And Artemis is now set up as one step in a time. But it costs lots of money, and I come back to the intervention of the lady up there. It costs lots of money. But if you think where we spend money for other things, not to even speak of defense and others, well, this is what we need to weigh and what you as young people have to gestalt. You have to make it work. You have to have the right vision and make it work. Be as enthusiastic as we were when I was a student and just go do it. It will happen.
Thank you very much.
Hello. Yeah. Thank you for your presentation and the insight towards what's going on right now. I want to ask you, I personally believe that the space is the solution for almost every problem in our day-to-day life. Because from the moon race, we got a lot of inventions that are not only used for space, but right now that are improving our life right now. I want to ask you that you have worked with many organizations, so is there enough enthusiasm as it was before? Because that's what I think is the most driving parameter. Like, right now, private companies are investing, but they are investing for their own profit. Like, we as a youth also need the direction for this, because we are enthusiastic, but we don't know if there is enough enthusiasm left. That's my question.
Well, if space were a solution for all of our problems on Earth, that would be phenomenal, but that's of course not the case. We need to put it back into where space indeed can contribute. This is lots. Second point, that people make money from their space investments is totally normal. That's the site of industry, is to earn money, because they don't invest their own money into new systems, new space stations, new communication satellites just for the beauty of it. They want to make money. And this is exactly what's happened with aeronautics. It started with enthusiasts, it started with government support, it started with all kinds of ways. Eventually it became a business, and it's totally normal. So enthusiasm for space, I think, is very, very, very broad, but we need to have a critical enthusiasm. That's why I showed you space debris, for example. I could have shown you a few more examples where it does not really work perfectly well. But again, let's make it work. Let's make it work, because the potential contribution of space to our life on Earth and to sustainability is much larger than most people realize.
Thank you.
My question is linked to the previous one, and I'd like to ask, like, with this new space...
Speak up a bit.
I'm sorry. With this new space concept, new actors are, like, raising, so private companies, but the solution for you is, like, cooperation. But if we have more people involved, is not cooperation much difficult? Like, because you have to work with more people. So if it's just the agencies, there are few, but like if private companies that have also different concept, for example, for Elon Musk, he has like his own strong ideas. So it's not going to be more difficult to cooperate towards a common goal?
Well, if you look at the ISS, it's a perfect proof that it can be done. Personally, I think, and I was instrumental, I admit, getting the Russians and the Americans together for the ISS together with us in Europe. And it was an absolutely wonderful, correct decision at that time, and I still defend it today. We should have also gotten the Chinese and the Indians into it. Okay? That didn't happen for political reasons, not for reasons that we as space engineers or scientists would have liked to see. And we see now with this change in the blocks of the US, Europe, or the Western bloc, if you will, China and Russia, we see a separation of collaboration. There is a big piece of a Mars re-entry vehicle out in Thales Alenia, which sits there to be retransported back to Russia, a very, very sad thing, because, not because of something that happened from space, but because we on this Earth didn't continue to work peacefully together. So you can turn this whichever way you like. That's why I say, let's make sure we have an independent Europe, a strong and independent Europe, with which we can indeed make sure we determine at least our destiny in the right way. And you, as students, need to fight on with it. I did my part of it, and I still do it. But you need to really fight on to it to make it happen.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Professor. I will be very brief. Which suggestion would you give to young professionals that are working on space law and space regulation?
Well, I think I've given you the real insight into what is happening on the legal and political side. We need to make sure that the original treaty of the United Nations continues to live and work on this. It needs to live in terms of also its legal contents, because the world is changing and regulations need to be updated as we go. But keep it updated in the same esprit of making space a peaceful place to live together. That's my recommendation.
Let us thank once more Professor Heinz Stover for an exceptional lecture. And this is the conclusion of this event.
Well, thank you, Marcelo. Thank you, and good luck to you.